I'm going to try and talk for about 35 to 40 minutes, and then we can go to questions and answers, and I'll be willing to entertain questions for as long as you folks would like. The subject I want to talk about today is America's threat environment in the year 2006, and to some extent, America's threat environment over the next 20 years. Now, I'm going to limit my discussion to what I define as direct military threats to the United States. I'm not going to consider problems like AIDS and global warming, which I definitely think are serious problems facing not only the United States but the international community, but I don't view them as direct military threats. I'm also going to not talk about the possibility of, say, a nuclear war between India and Pakistan, not because it's of no consequence to the United States, it surely is of great consequence to the United States, but because it's not a direct military threat, which is what I want to focus on. I'm also not going to talk about the possibility of mass murder or genocide, again, because I don't think they represent direct military threats to our security. And again, I don't for one second want to make light of mass murder or genocide any more than I want to make light of AIDS or global warming. But just for purposes of bounding the discussion, I'm going to focus on direct military threats. I think that the United States faces threats or potential threats from three sets of actors. First, other great powers. Second, rogue states with weapons of mass destruction. And third, non-state terrorist groups like Al-Qaeda. And what I'd like to do in my presentation is talk about the threat that the United States faces from each of those three different kinds of actors, starting first of all with great power threats. The most dangerous threat to the United States is another great power that has the economic and military wherewithal to be what we call a potential peer competitor. In other words, another great power that has the capability to dominate its region of the world the way the United States dominates the Western Hemisphere, and then project power to other regions of the world. In other words, a country like the Soviet Union that threatened to dominate not only Europe but also Asia and had the capability to project power into areas like the Middle East and areas like Africa as well. During the 20th century, the United States faced four potential peer competitors: Imperial Germany, Imperial Japan, Nazi Germany, and the former Soviet Union. The United States fought wars against the first three of those potential peer competitors and played a key role in putting them on the scrap heap of history. The United States fortunately did not fight World War III against the Soviet Union, but nevertheless we engaged in the Cold War for roughly 45 years, and we played a key role in putting the Soviet Union on the scrap heap of history. The fact of the matter is the United States does not like potential peer competitors. It does not like for one second the idea of another great power possibly dominating the Eurasian continent and then throwing its weight around in other regions of the world. As far as we're concerned, there's only one country that's allowed to do that, and that's the United States of America. And we have every intention of keeping it that way, as we demonstrated in the 20th century. And as the first Bush administration in 1992 and the present Bush administration in 2002 and more recently made clear. But the good news is we don't face a potential peer competitor today. There is no great power in the system that stands a chance in a war with the United States. I believe there are only two other great powers in the system at this point in time, China and Russia. And both are remarkably weak when compared to the United States. Now, the argument that many people make is that there may be serious trouble down the road on this front, in large part because many people believe that China is rising and China will eventually be a peer competitor. As you all know, the two principal ingredients of military power are population size and wealth. China now has 5 times the population of the United States. So if China were in the future to become a giant Hong Kong, given that population advantage and given all the wealth that would come with being a giant Hong Kong, we would be facing a competitor the likes of which we have never seen before. It's very important to understand that in the Cold War, the Soviet Union probably had at its max 1/3 the gross national product of the United States. Some people say 1/2 the gross national product of the United States. I doubt that. I think they probably had about 1/3 the gross national product of the United States at their peak. We're talking here about a situation where China would have somewhere on the order of 2, 3, maybe even 4 times the gross national product of the United States. Now, is that going to happen? It's very hard to say. If you go to China today and you talk to the Chinese about their potential for rising, most Chinese will tell you that it's not likely to happen, in good part for demographic reasons, as a consequence of the one-child policy and what that will mean for economic growth in the future. I don't have a clear view on whether China is likely to continue to rise, but all I will say is that at this point, China as a potential peer competitor is a distant threat. So we have no really serious threat on the great power front at this point in time. Now let me make one caveat to that argument. Even if China does not rise, there is still a possibility that the United States could end up in a shooting war with China or even with Russia. I think it is highly unlikely because of, number one, the presence of nuclear weapons, and number two, because the United States is so much more powerful than both China and Russia. But one can posit plausible, if not likely scenarios, if unlikely scenarios, involving a war between China and the United States. And the logical place to go is Taiwan. It is possible that we could end up in a shooting war with the Chinese over Taiwan in the next 10 years. Is that likely? No, but it is possible. So my bottom line with regard to other great power threats in the system is that at this point in time and for the immediate future, there is no potential peer competitor out there, and there is not likely to be anytime soon. And with regard to possible wars involving places like Taiwan, we do have to worry about that scenario, but it is an unlikely scenario. So we're in excellent shape when it comes to our standing with other great powers. Second set of concerns that we have are the so-called rogue states. This includes Iran, North Korea, Iraq under Saddam Hussein, and maybe Syria as well. My argument with regard to the rogue states is that the threat is greatly overblown by the Bush administration and by most American security experts, and that, in fact, American policy has done a great deal to make these problems even worse than they otherwise would be. Let me say a few words about this. We worry greatly about rogue states for 2 reasons. One, because of the possibility that they may have WMD, and there we're mainly talking about nuclear weapons. But we also worry about rogue states because they threaten to support terrorists who might attack us. Let me deal with each of those problems in turn. First of all, I think the WMD threat from rogue states is greatly overblown. According to the conventional wisdom, it has 4 dimensions to it. First of all, it's said that rogue states can blackmail the United States. Condoleezza Rice and George Bush, in the run-up to the war in Iraq, were fond of telling us that if Saddam had nuclear weapons, he could blackmail us. Second danger is not that they blackmail us, but they actually use the weapons against us. The third danger is that someone like Saddam would conquer another country with his conventional forces, say Kuwait, somewhere down the road, much like he did in 1990, and this time deter us from throwing him out of Kuwait by threatening to use nuclear weapons if we went to war against him. And fourth, there's the great danger that Saddam Hussein or some Ayatollah or Kim Il-jong, will surreptitiously give nuclear weapons to rogue states. I think these are all implausible scenarios, and I want to tell you why. First of all, with regard to the threat to use nuclear weapons and to blackmail us, there is simply no way a state with nuclear weapons can blackmail the United States, because we have nuclear weapons, and therefore the threat to use them against us is not credible. For Saddam Hussein or anyone else to be able to blackmail us, they have to have nuclear weapons, and we can't have nuclear weapons. If Saddam Hussein says, "I'm going to use nuclear weapons against you, George Bush, unless you do X or Y or Z," all George Bush has to say is, "Saddam, if you use nuclear weapons against us, I want you to understand that we will retaliate, if not in kind, even more massively. And we will turn you into a smoking, radiating ruin before you know what hit you." You all know the Soviet Union had thousands of nuclear weapons during the Cold War. It was run by murderous thugs like Joe Stalin, Nikita Khrushchev, and Leonid Brezhnev, just to mention three names. The Soviet Union never attempted to blackmail the United States. Why do you think, why does Condoleezza Rice think, and why does George Bush think that Saddam Hussein could blackmail us when in fact all of those ruthless Soviet leaders were unable to do so? The answer is he can't blackmail us. And the same basic logic applies with regard to nuclear use. There's no way that he can use nuclear weapons against us, or a North Korean or Iranian leader can use nuclear weapons against us without being wiped off the face of the earth with an American retaliatory force. So the threat that Saddam Hussein with nuclear weapons allows him to blackmail us or actually use nuclear weapons against us doesn't wash. What about the argument that someone like Saddam or an Ayatollah could invade a country like Kuwait and then use nuclear weapons as a shield to keep the United States from pushing him out of Kuwait, much the way we did in 1991? Same basic logic applies here. You tell Saddam Hussein, "We're coming in to Kuwait, come hell or high water, and we're going to fight a conventional war against you. We have no intention of invading Baghdad and overthrowing your regime. We just plan to throw you out of Kuwait. And we understand you have nuclear weapons, but you want to be very clear on this one. We have nuclear weapons as well. And if you start to get an itchy trigger finger, you want to be aware that we will have an itchy trigger finger as well. And we may go first. And if you go first, you can be assured that we will incinerate you." And he won't use nuclear weapons, because his survival and the survival of his society will be at stake. Of course, the only way, and I'll get to this in a second, that he would use nuclear weapons is if you threaten his survival, which, of course, is why he wants nuclear weapons to start with. I'll talk more about that in a second. But the idea that we couldn't do Kuwait 2 or Desert Storm 2 because Saddam had nuclear weapons, in my opinion, doesn't wash. What about a possibility that a rogue state would secretly give WMD to a terrorist group like Al-Qaeda? This, again, was a great fear of the Bush administrations and many Americans in the run-up to the war in Iraq. This, too, I think, is an implausible argument. First of all, they could never be confident that they could do this in a way that wouldn't be detected by the United States. They'd never be confident. And you understand that if we found out that they were giving nuclear weapons to Al-Qaeda, they would pay a very serious price. The United States would be enraged. Saddam had nothing to do with 9/11, and you know what happened to him. He's gone now. He had nothing to do with 9/11. He's gone. You can imagine how we would react if we had any evidence that he was giving WMD to terrorists. And you might say to yourself, John, what if he concludes, however, that he has a secret way of doing this? Well, there's two points to be made there. One is, if he gave nuclear weapons to Al-Qaeda, there's almost no question that Al-Qaeda would use those weapons. And if Al-Qaeda used those weapons, there is a very good chance, a very good chance, that we would incinerate him anyway, even if we didn't have hard knowledge that he was responsible for giving those weapons to Al-Qaeda. All we would have to do is suspect that. Again, we toppled the regime in Iraq, even though Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11. The United States is a ruthless country, is not to be underestimated. So he could never be sure, Saddam, that Al-Qaeda wouldn't use those weapons and that we wouldn't believe that he gave the weapons to Al-Qaeda anyway. And all there has to do is be some reasonable certainty that we would, or some reasonable chance that we would attack Iraq if that scenario played itself out for Saddam not to give nuclear weapons to Al-Qaeda. Because the end result, again, is he would be incinerated. And most leaders in this world are interested in survival. So I think that's not a serious concern. There actually are two implausible, but nevertheless possible, two scenarios that are possible that we should worry about. This is the reason I think we should do what we can to prevent nuclear proliferation to countries like Iraq and Pakistan and so forth and so on. One is the danger of a madman getting his hands on nuclear weapons. It's, again, not likely, but it is a possibility, and one should worry about that. The second scenario that you should worry about is where a state with nuclear weapons collapses from within, and there is fissile material floating around, and terrorists gain control of that fissile material. This is the main concern we have with regard to Pakistan. I don't think we worry about Pakistani leaders, whether it's Musharraf or anyone else, giving nuclear weapons or fissile material to terrorists. I think what we worry about is Pakistan collapsing and then some terrorist organization or some organization that's sympathetic to the terrorists getting their hands on the fissile material and then producing a bomb and using it against us. So those are the two main dangers, I think, that come from rogue states having WMD. And some, I think, WMD do not provide rogue states with an offensive capability against the United States. One might then ask, well, if they don't provide an offensive capability against the United States for these rogue states, why do they want these weapons? The answer is very simple. They want these weapons because they're the best deterrent that money can buy. If you live in a world where the United States has put you on the axis of evil and is talking about invading your country, and you do not have the conventional wherewithal to deter the United States or to fight the United States, there is no better way to deal with this problem than to develop nuclear weapons. The Iranians and the North Koreans would be fools not to develop nuclear weapons of their own. If any of you were playing North Korea's hand or playing Iran's hand, you would develop nuclear weapons too. Of course, from an American point of view, it doesn't make sense to see those countries have nuclear weapons for the reasons I just said. I'm not saying it's good for us, but we're not talking about us. We're talking about them. The question is, why are they developing nuclear weapons? Do you think it's because the Iranians want to start World War III with nuclear weapons against the United States? Of course not. The Iranians are very worried about what happened in Iraq happening to them. They don't want Uncle Sam paying them a visit. And they understand very well that the best way to prevent Uncle Sam from paying you a visit is to have a nuclear arsenal. All of this points out that the Bush administration's policies, the Bush Doctrine in particular, just make a bad situation worse. There's no question that well before George Bush took office that North Korea and Iran and Iraq were pursuing nuclear weapons. I'm not in the business of blaming the Bush administration for creating that problem. But what the Bush administration has done is taken a bad problem, or a serious problem, and made it worse by threatening these countries. When you create an axis of evil, right, and you put Iran and North Korea on it as well as Iraq, and then you invade Iraq, and you make it clear to the world that Iran and North Korea's turn is coming soon, that's no longer the case, of course, because we've shot off both our feet in Iraq, for reasons I'll get into in a minute, but that's not the way we were talking before we invaded Iraq and when George Bush landed on the aircraft carrier on May 1st. If you were the Iranians or the North Koreans at that point in time, you would have been quaking in your boots, as they were. But they just did not roll over and play dead. They decided, well, before that, but they put their pedal to the metal at the time to develop nuclear weapons. Again, not for offensive purposes, not to give them to terrorists, but to protect themselves. By the way, you've all noticed that the United States of America has a huge nuclear arsenal, and it has no intention of giving it up. I haven't heard any of you running around saying the United States should abandon all of its nuclear weapons. Have you been reading where the New York Times and the Chicago Tribune and the Los Angeles Times and the Boston Globe have been calling for us to abandon our nuclear deterrent? No. No, we love our nuclear weapons. Well, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. So don't be surprised that these states want WMD, and not for offensive purposes. There's a second reason, of course, that many people argue that we should worry about these rogue states, and that is because they sponsor terrorism. And here, it's especially true with regard to Iran and Syria. There's no question that they support terrorists, much more so than Saddam Hussein. And as you know, Iran and Syria both are staunch supporters of Hezbollah. My basic argument here is that these terrorist groups are not a serious threat to the United States. Hezbollah, the IRA, Hamas, Islamic Jihad. I'm not happy that they are out there. Arguing that these are good organizations. I don't like terrorism. But they're not threatening us. Hezbollah is not our problem. Hamas is not our problem. Al-Qaeda is, and I'll get to Al-Qaeda in due course. But the idea that there's this global war on terrorism, right, and all these terrorist organizations are part of a seamless web, and that we have to take on every terrorist organization in the world. And moreover, we have to run around knocking off states like Iran, Syria, Iraq, because they support terrorism, is a prescription for real trouble. It's a prescription for real trouble. Anyway, the point is that Iran and Syria do support terrorist organizations. But they are not supporting terrorist organizations that are at war with the United States. And I think given the climate they live in, they would not support terrorist organizations that would purposely target the United States, because the United States might very well come after them. So my argument is, with regard to the rogue states and nuclear weapons, I think there is a threat there. The threat is the threat of a madman or the dissolution of the state and fission material floating around. But otherwise, not that serious a problem. And with regard to those rogue states sponsoring terrorism, not a really serious threat. Certainly not a threat that we can't deal with. This brings us to non-state terrorist organizations, the third set of actors that we have to worry about. There is no question that we face a serious problem here. Don't want to make light of that. One of the principal reasons I adamantly opposed the war in Iraq was that I believed that by invading Iraq, we were taking our eye off the real threat, which was Al-Qaeda, and that was a big mistake. I'm fully convinced that we have to worry greatly about Al-Qaeda, and that the United States should concentrate on defeating it. But just to talk a little bit about the global war on terrorism. As I said before, there are many terrorist organizations out there. The Tamil Tigers, talked about the IRA, Hamas, Hezbollah, and so forth and so on. But again, most of these organizations are not targeting the United States. And my view is, if they're not targeting the United States, leave them alone. I am not interested in running around the globe and picking a fight with every terrorist organization out there so that we can rid the world of terrorism. I understand that there are a number of Americans, especially in the Bush administration, who would like to do this. But I think it's a very foolish policy, right? What we should be concerned with are those terrorist organizations that have their crosshairs on the United States. And on that front, we have one very prominent and very dangerous adversary, and that very dangerous adversary is Al-Qaeda. Now, some people may say, that's not true, John. We actually have two threats today. We have a threat from Al-Qaeda, and we also have a threat from terrorists in Iraq. But I would ask you, why don't we have a threat from terrorists in Iraq? There's no question we have terrorists coming at our ears in Iraq. I don't dispute that for one second. But why is that the case? I would remind you that we had no terrorist problem from Iraq before we invaded that country. There was no terrorist threat. This link between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda only exists in the minds of the neoconservatives and the upper echelons of the Bush administration. There was no link there. Okay? And there was no terrorist threat from Iraq. Iraq is actually very different than Iran and Syria in this regard. We invaded Iraq and we created a giant terrorist problem for ourselves. This gets to the point that Bob Pape makes in his book on the strategic logic of suicide terrorism, that the principal cause of our terrorism problem is our occupation of countries in the Arab and Islamic world. It was our occupation of Iraq that caused a terrorism problem that did not exist before. There was no terrorism problem for the United States in Iraq until March 2003, when we invaded the country. So that problem is one that we created ourselves. Now, what about Al-Qaeda? It's a different matter. Now, there are two ways of thinking about the threat from Al-Qaeda, and they mainly revolve around this whole question of why people in the Arab and Islamic world hate us so much. One line of argument, or one answer to that question, why do they hate us, is that they hate us for who we are. They hate our institutions. They hate our culture. They hate our civilization, to put it in Samuel Huntington's terms. And basically, what we face from the Arab and Islamic world, and from Al-Qaeda in particular, is an existential threat. This is the clash of civilizations, and we, in fact, are involved in World War IV. There's an alternative explanation, and the alternative explanation is that they hate us not for who we are, but for what we do. Specifically, they detest the presence of American troops in Saudi Arabia before March 1993, and now they detest the presence of American troops in Iraq. They detest our unconditional support for Israel against the Palestinians. They detest our strong support for authoritarian regimes in the region. They detest us for our sanctions against the Iraqi people in the 1990s, which by virtually all accounts killed hundreds of thousands of innocent people. In other words, it's our policies that they hate. There's no clash of civilizations. And in this story, Al-Qaeda is not an existential threat. Right? It's a threat that's largely driven by our policies. Now, the question is, which is the right answer? I think there is a huge amount of poll data and anecdotal evidence that shows, at least to me, beyond a doubt, that they hate us because of our policies and not because of who we are. I think that if you look at the poll data, that large numbers of people, clear majorities throughout the Arab and Islamic world, are deeply attracted to democracy and in many ways have great respect for American institutions and for Western civilization. What they dislike, and what they dislike intensely, are our policies. And I believe that the main reason that we are at war with Al-Qaeda, number one, and number two, the main reason that Al-Qaeda has so much sympathy in the Arab and Islamic world is because so many people in the Arab and Islamic world dislike our policies. Thus, the question here is whether we are likely to change our policies anytime soon. I think the answer is unequivocally no. We're not going to change our policies. It didn't matter one iota whether John Kerry won in 2004 or George Bush won in 2004 regarding American policy towards the Middle East. John Kerry is no more likely to put any pressure on the Israelis to settle that conflict than George Bush is. Hillary Clinton is no more likely to put any pressure on the Israelis than John McCain. It is simply not going to happen. With regard to the war in Iraq, listening to John Kerry and to George Bush talk about what American policy should be is like listening to Tweedledee and Tweedledum. It just doesn't matter. We're not going to change our policy in the Middle East anytime soon. And the end result of that is that people in the Arab and Islamic world are going to continue to hate us or dislike us, if you like a less offensive word. And we're going to continue to have terrorists coming at us from that particular region. And of course, Al-Qaeda is the main threat there. Now, final question we have to ask ourselves is whether or not Al-Qaeda is a mortal enemy, given that the problem is not going away. Is it a mortal enemy? And my view on this one is that Al-Qaeda would not be an especially difficult threat to deal with. It would not be an especially worrisome threat were it not for the possibility that it might acquire nuclear weapons. If you take nuclear weapons out of the equation, Al-Qaeda is just not that serious a threat. I think it's extremely unlikely that they would ever be able to pull off another 9/11. And when you look at all the help we've actually gotten from countries in the Arab and Islamic world in dealing with Al-Qaeda. You understand states do not like non-state actors that can get them into trouble. You all understand that Syria was going to great lengths after 9/11 to cooperate with the United States against Al-Qaeda. Why? Because Syria doesn't like Al-Qaeda running around out there doing things to the United States that will enrage the United States and get the United States to come into the Middle East in ways that don't redound to Syria's benefit. So Syria helped us a lot with Al-Qaeda. Right? States do not like non-state actors that they cannot control. This gets back to my point as to why Syria, Iraq, Iran are not going to give weapons of mass destruction to Al-Qaeda. They can't control them. And Al-Qaeda could get them into real serious trouble. That was my point to you. So actually, we don't have that much difficulty getting cooperation against Al-Qaeda. And if we had a half-sophisticated foreign policy in this country, we'd go a long way towards solving this problem. But of course, that's not going to happen because we're not going to change any of our policies. Okay. But the fact of the matter is Al-Qaeda, even given that situation, is not that big a threat, save for one consideration. And that one consideration is they may get their hands on weapons of mass destruction, and they were really talking about nuclear weapons. So what's the bottom line here? The bottom line here is that as far as great power threats are concerned, there is no potential peer competitor in the system at this point in time, nor is there likely to be one anytime soon. And the possibility of a war between the United States and China or the United States and Russia is always there, but it is not likely. And if it were to occur, the United States is by far the most powerful state in the system. So in terms of great powers, we are in excellent shape. In terms of rogue states, again, I would prefer that Iran not have nuclear weapons. I would prefer that Iraq not have nuclear weapons. But if they acquire nuclear weapons, they will have virtually no offensive capability against the United States. It's not that serious a threat. With regard to rogue states supporting terrorists, not that serious a threat. The main threat that we face today is from Al-Qaeda. And the reason it is such a serious threat is because of the possibility that Osama bin Laden will get his hands on WMD. If that were not the case, the United States would be really in the catbird seat in terms of the threat environment that confronts us. Thank you.